I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
Did you know that Monopoly was invented by a woman in the 1900s?
This week, we are speaking with Tom Forsyth, a game aficionado and special expert on the game Monopoly.
But it wasn't always called Monopoly. It was called the Landlord's Game, invented by Elizabeth Maggie in 1904.
In this episode, Tom reveals the unexpected background of the world's most popular money game and its unique influence on our lives.
Well, my name is Thomas Forsyth. Live in Portland, Oregon, where I live and work. And we're talking a little bit about the Landlord's Game today.
I've been wanting to talk to you for like a long time, Tom. Let's start with the history of the Landlord's Game and the connection to Monopoly.
We really have to go back to the mid-1800s. And James McGee was a newspaper man. And in about 1858, he accompanied Abe Lincoln and Douglas on their debates, along with a publisher from the Chicago Tribune. Of course, shortly thereafter, Lincoln became president. But he had a daughter named Lizzie, who was born just after the war in 1866. And her father's background in politics and such really set the foundation for this young child to have a education in politics and reading and writing and even printing, because her father would do the typeset and teach her how at an early age. So this gave her a good foundation for her later invention of the Landlord's Game, which would come about the turn of the century, around 1900.
So what exactly is the Landlord Game?
Well, to understand it, I think you have to delve a little further back into something was happening during the late 19th century, early 20th century. There was a populist movement in America revolving around something called single tax. And that would be a levy of a single tax on the rental value of land or natural resources. This single tax movement later became known as Georgism, after its most famous proponent, Henry George, who had outlined his thoughts in a very famous book called Progress and Poverty about 1879. This was a bestseller. I mean, this book, they said, only sold second to the Bible in the United States. It was very well read. And George was very well known in 1886, I think. He made a bid for New York mayor, New York City. And George had proposed a simplified and sort of equitable tax system whose revenue is based exclusively on land and natural resource rents. No additional taxes anywhere on improvements or buildings, those kind of taxes. George didn't really believe that land should be owned, but it already was in the United States. So he worked with this basic tax system he felt would develop a better society. Lizzie was introduced to this as she grew up and started formulating some ideas about taxation and land values and property rents and all this. And something else that was really happening when Lizzie was growing up were the railroads were expanding, starting probably the 1860s through 1900. And the construction of the railroads were an expensive venture. Private banks didn't think they were going to be able to pay off these debts. So Congress had provided assistance to the railroad companies in form of land grants. And these railroads received millions of acres of land. And in the end, four out of the five, I think, transcontinental railroads were built using all this help from the federal government. Well, if you think about it, train comes along and builds a small little wooden platform and stops the train. What's going to happen? Well, commerce moved by rail. There were no highways, there were no cars, there were no airplanes. Ships were only on, rivers or along the coast. And a horse and wagon couldn't compete. So the railroads amassed great wealth by simply renting their land. You put a railroad stop, everybody had to start building around it. And the property values would go up and up as people would start to build on their land. And they could charge higher rents as those areas became more desirable. And they could also sell land off at a huge profit because they got it essentially for free from the government. That started concentrating wealth in the country. And some of them went together in trust. They would reduce their competition and essentially in a local area, railroads were a monopoly, right? Because there's only one in town.
So that makes a lot of sense that basically Lizzie saw all that. She got introduced to these political, or these ideas, or these, what was happening, what was going on at that time. And are you saying that she basically translated this into the landlord's game?
Yeah, she started tinkering around with a game design right around the turn of the century. And she had, one of the first things she added was the railroads. Okay, so they're representing essentially monopolies. And she actually wrote this into the rules that you could put a couple railroads together and get a trust and raise your fares, or you could own all four and have a monopoly and increase your rents even, or your fares even more. And this is really where monopoly essentially was born, that whole idea in the game. She added other spaces like foreign ownership of U.S. land. The biggest space on the board was Lord Blueblood's estate, which was English ownership of U.S. property. And if you landed on it, where did you go? You went to jail on the other side of the board, right? So here she is, you know, addressing that. Properties increased in value as location became more desirable on the board. Wall Street versus Goat Alley, right? So, yeah, Wall Street's probably going to have higher property prices. Utilities were also represented by gas lighting. She called it soak 'em lighting, you know, soak you up all your money. And she had a local transport, which was slam bang trolley. Originally on her first earlier designs, that was water company. But you had to pay taxes to the water company and to the utilities. I think it was a gas lighting utility. It wasn't even electric at that time. There was a poorhouse or a Central Park free. You could stay in the park for free. That later became free parking, right, as cars came around. That's where free parking came from. It wasn't on. It was originally camping in the city park for free, trying to get some money or loan, get a loan from another player. You could tax anyone for those, you know, kinds of use on the utilities. Mother Earth was what became Go. And as you rounded the board, you earned your wages upon Mother Earth. And that's where you got your essentially $200, you know, on Go. It was called Mother Earth, which I thought in the original game design is really, really interesting. Another thing was absolute necessities, food, clothing, fuel. There were spaces for that. You landed on that, you got taxed. Because she was trying to sort of point out this inequity that would occur in this game as houses were built and rents went up and properties were owned and you had to start paying taxes here and there and get sent to jail for landing in the wrong space and so on. So this formulates sort of her idea of the monopolistic side of the game.
So why would she design that game? What's the motivation for her?
Well, it sounds a little counterproductive and to be looking at something like single tax in her background. We talked about the Georgism, right? And design this monopolistic game. But the people who are familiar with Monopoly that came from this game have only played the monopolistic rule set. She designed it with two rule sets. The second part of the rules was single tax. And the players who were getting taken out by the monopolist could essentially vote to flip the rules on a monopolist and redistribute their wealth. And she did this through a single tax system based on Henry George, so that basically the property rents were taxed 100%. And that tax went into a public treasury or a community chest and would pay for things like free college. The game actually has free college cards. What an idea.
Wow, that's just awesome. So what happened? Why did the landlord's game not persist? What happened after that?
I have a couple thoughts on that. The very earliest games, which were handmade, were played, you know, with both rule sets. We don't have really many written copies of the rules. People taught each other the rules verbally. But I'm under the impression that if everybody won, like in the single tax rules, it wasn't probably as much fun as a game. You know, it was educational, but after you played it a couple times, it's like, I want to win. You know, I want to be the winner of the game. And so I think that that part of the rule set sort of by attrition got dropped. And actually we can see that early on in how the game progressed through history as it worked its way from her first publication in 1906 into the later games that we became familiar with. But she did design it. She did design it as a child's game, an educational children's game. And just before her published game, she was pretty much just talking monopolistic, but she was really clearly thinking about single tax. So she obviously incorporated those things together.
So Tom, she seemed to think that a game could really educate people. Like, do you have thoughts on how games influence the way people think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is when you sit down to play any game, you know, your basic idea is having fun and playing it with other people. You're interacting. Of course, video games, you're doing it over the web, but board games in their original form is you sit down around a family table and, you know, you're talking and you're chanting, you know, everybody's, and so it becomes a very involving thing. And if that game can lead you in a particular direction through its rule set, then you get an education, maybe not even without even really recognizing it as an education. It depends on the game designer, I think.
So it sounds like the competitive games where someone really wants to win are more popular than the more collaborative games where everyone wins or there's no real distinction. Do you have an opinion about why that happens that way?
Well, I think, you know, there's some thought that humans are just instinctively competitive, you know, that we tend to have a natural point about us of trying to get ahead and not always favoring everybody else. That's not always true. I mean, we can be very altruistic, but I think in game playing, just like sports, often you want a clear winner.
I've heard that Monopoly is the most played game in the United States. 96%, I think, of the American population has played Monopoly at one point in life. So it's a very popular game still today. How do you see, was the mind, the American mind, sort of say, influenced by Monopoly?
You know, I think that it may have even brought out more competitiveness with people, that lacking that other part of the rule set of more fair, equal distribution of wealth, using that wealth to educate the population and so on. This is like land grab. Well, grab your properties, build, charge everybody rent, you know, charge them more rent if you can get more property and so on. Yeah. So I don't think, although a fun game, I don't know that it was necessarily a very good education in that sense, except for the people, most of the people lost. I mean, there's only one winner. So all those other players who are losing all the time might start to think a little bit about, you know, this is really unfair. Every time I play this game, I get wiped out.
It was already unfair when it was copied. I think it was 1934 by Parker Brothers. Can you talk about this taking over the game, so to say, and then make it into a commercialized game? I guess not in the sense of what Lizzie Maggie had imagined it. And she was upset about it too, I think.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the game had worked its way largely, you know, her published game had one group of followers and handmade games that were being handmade who had sort of lost the single tax rules were interchangeably called Landlords and Monopoly for quite a time. But by about the early 1930s, it was generally just called Monopoly. There was another game that spun directly off it called Finance that had been put on the market slightly before Parker Brothers. It was selling pretty well. And the Charles Darrow is credited with inventing Monopoly, and he copied it literally down to typos in the rule sets. Marvin Gardens, there's a fun little story. Marvin Gardens to this day is misspelled with an I because it is a combination of Margate City, M-A-R, and Ventor City, V-E-N, on either side of Atlantic City. He didn't know that. And the people who copied the game in the town where he lived made that typo, and he copied the typo. So we still have this misspelling on the game today. But Parker Brothers really wanted to get exclusive control of this game. They knew about the Landlord's game. They knew about the history. The problem is Lizzie had patented the game, and the patent had gone into public domain. So they were unable to patent. copyrights were pretty questionable. I mean, Darrow copied, plagiarized it completely, but they basically did a backdoor, had Darrow invent the game, and he said, yes, I invented the game, transferred copyright to Parker Brothers, and when they patented, they did an interesting switch. They contacted Lizzie and said, we're going to buy the rights to your Landlord's game. Well, when her first patent ran out, she repatented the game. But you have to redesign it. You can't use the same patent. Again, you can't take it back out of public domain. So she essentially designed a new game by a different name. They substituted it. They bought her second patent and said, we bought the Landlord's game patent. Everybody just said, oh, okay, fine, $500, you bought the patent. But they bought the patent to a different game that didn't have the basic clauses and claims of the Landlords. So they pulled a little switcheroo, and Lizzie finally figured this out. She went to the newspapers and was complaining, and they buried her pretty quickly in the press. They even put out a Landlord's game in 1939, and it had lakes in it and trails and all sorts of things. Interesting enough, there's still some spaces on there that can be found in her very, very earliest Landlord's games. So there's some telltale signs. I have a Monopoly board from Parker Brothers that actually has her second patent number on it, and they pulled it really quick because they said, you know, we really don't want to point that direction for people to start investigating. But they essentially monopolized Monopoly. Lizzie died unknown and penniless, and Darrow ended up becoming a millionaire. So it was a pretty unfair thing.
Monopolized Monopoly. That's pretty funny. It is. How did you get to know all the story, and how did you discover the Landlord's game in the first place?
Well, I was visiting my parents for Thanksgiving holiday in the late 1990s, and after a good festive dinner, we decided to play a board game. My dad went in the garage and pulled out Parcheesi, Monopoly, and maybe Chutes and Ladders or whatever, and he set them down, and there was one other board with him. He said, well, I think this one's called the Landlord's game. He says, it seems to be a bit like Monopoly. He didn't really know much about it. He says, well, it was your grandfather's on your mother's side. And I opened it up and I'm looking at it. Okay. Four railroads, go to jail, chance, properties, houses. I looked at Monopoly sitting next to it, and I'm like, and I had actually studied some patent law. I'd been spending time in a patent library, so I knew enough to say there's something terribly wrong. Both games have a patent number on them. So I immediately contacted the patent office, got both patents, set them side by side, and said, there's just something not right about this. And it sent up all sorts of red flags. And I started digging into the history, and a certain amount of time went by, and I connected by a guy named Ralph Ansbach, who had actually done a court case, the Lanalei's U.S. Supreme Court. And during that court case, during the investigation part, he had uncovered a whole bunch of the history. Well, when the two of us got together, we're able to link up stories and ideas. And, you know, we went on for years just digging through and uncovering a lot of the history and sort of rewriting it. Landlord's game was so rare in all his years of investigation, he had never seen one. No Landlord's game had ever been published on the web anywhere. No picture of one. Parker Brothers probably systematically shredded them, and the rest went by attrition. So this game that I have is incredibly rare. I was able to be the first one to really publish a picture online of the game.
So from discovering that something is wrong to then getting the trademark, that's a different step, though.
Yeah. Well, it occurred to me at some point along the way is that, well, if I'm the only one with a copy of the original full game, that I'm the only one who could potentially bring it back and produce it. Well, the game's patent is public domain, the copyright's public domain. So how do I produce a product that I'm not just basically do all the work, getting it all together, send it out, and anybody can copy it and make it their own? And the trademark only protects the name of the game with the person who's producing it, okay, or the company that's producing the game. And they can be brought back out of public domain if they're not in use, unlike copyrights and patents. So I looked at it and said, well, if I can trademark the game, then anybody can produce the game, but I'm the only one who can call it the Landlord's game. And if that's the case, then if I brand the game history using the history, anybody who looks for the predecessor of Monopoly, they're only going to look for one game, the Landlord's Game. And therefore, I have a market that I can sell and produce in. And I've never been real strict. I have a couple people online who are selling a game. I just had them change the name. But, you know, it's essentially a copy of my game or Lizzie's game. So, and I spent 7 years trying to get one of the trademarks in the U.S. So it was a bit of a journey.
So where's your motivation, Tom, in this? Is it to basically you have found a market for a game or a market in general? It doesn't matter what kind of game it is. Or is it the original message of Lizzie Maggie?
It's a little bit twofold. One is it gives me a chance to potentially make a little income off of bringing a game to market. But at the same time, I really, really wanted to bring out Lizzie's original story. And so as I'm going through and talking to press, and which builds people to basically come to my website and maybe potentially buy a game, really my focus has been on things like Pot of Gold and talking about the history of the game and who Lizzie was and where the game came about, and really also putting her place proper in history. And so it's a symbiotic relationship.
Okay, so in the context of games and their influence on society, you know, at Pot of Gold, we're very much interested in the way we think about the systems that operate in society, and clearly taxation is one of those systems. How do you suppose the Landlord's Game informs or is relevant to what's going on in today's society?
It's really almost a perfect time to re-release this game. If you look what's going on in society, what was Bernie Sanders talking about? Free college, right? Well, the Landlord's Game has free college through its taxation system. That in itself right there, people talk about their property taxes getting too high, where a senior can't stay in their home that they've paid off in full because the property taxes are now higher than their original mortgage payments. And so, you know, I think that some of the basic ideas of non-competitiveness, of not concentrating wealth, and this was a lot of what I talked about the railroads, concentration of wealth with a very few people, the Rockefellers back then, that society can function better if we can distribute that wealth more evenly across society and educate our population and provide certain things without tax, the absolute necessities of life. You got to have food and shelter. And taxation, high taxation, can make that unaffordable for people. So I think a lot of the basic ideas of the game are actually very, very relevant to today's thinking and to the politics going on today.
So it sounds like it's staying in the capitalistic system, but kind of more about the distribution of its fruit, so to say, more like fairly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a more socialist leaning type of system. But I think, you know, that's where a good part of the country is leaning more progressively towards that direction. When I grew up, college was almost free. I mean, the tuition was like $50 for a state university in California. Nowadays, people become indentured servants to their loans, to their college loans. They can't get a job that pays well enough to pay off their loan. And what good does that do society?
Tom, it's been a fantastic interview and really, really informative about the games and influences on games on society. What is it that you would really like? What's close to your heart? What you would really like to bring out with the game and maybe a message to our listeners?
Well, a couple thoughts. That one, as I said, that Lizzie's place in history, I think, really needs to be cemented. That as a woman in a time when the suffragettes were fighting for the right to vote, she was already making patents. She was running her own business. She was supervising over men. She was invented what became essentially the most popular proprietary board game in the world. And she, like so many women, were left unrecognized in history. And I really, really want to bring back her place as an inventor and many of the other things that she actually did in her life, writing poetry and others' inventions and so on. I think that's important. And I think also bringing about some of the progressive thinking of the game and bringing that back out into the public, what the game was originally meant to be and how it was originally meant to be played.
Truly awesome and truly necessary in today's world, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful.
If anybody is interested in playing an original Landlord's game, I have produced a limited edition set, and I spent a lot of time matching the colors exactly. All the original typesetting that Lizzie did on the cards are all matched exactly, and it's a beautiful, really beautiful reproduction, and it's a chance to play the game. If you go to landlordsgame.info, you can see pictures of the game through history. You can read their rule sets. I've given some links for other reading, some great books that are out, and you can buy a game. There's a link right on the top of the website. Just click on that. It'll bring you into the store. Also, I'd like to do a little something for your listeners, and I'm going to post up in my coupon space on the game. If you put in Pot of Gold, I'll give you a little discount when you come in.
Okay. Wonderful. Right. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
So in my opinion, from a game design perspective, Monopoly is actually not such an interesting game.
Yeah, it's super boring. You know, I think we started cheating. Like, it was only fun when we could cheat as kids. You know.
Well, I don't want to overjudge it, yet it is so, so successful. You know, it's the most played money game in the world. I think they have 250 million sets sold, which is amazing for a board game. So somebody must like it.
Well, I think what Tom, like Tom said, they changed the rules to bring out our cutthroat selves, and that makes for a fun game. No matter who's playing, you want to win, and when you win, you feel good. And even though it's basically a boring game.
Oh, you don't feel really good. I mean, not everyone who wins that game feels good. Well, just want to say, you know, I never felt good winning.
Did you ever win?
I won, yes. But then when you win, yeah, very funny. When you win, everyone else loses.
And that's
not fun.
Yeah, that made
you sad? Yes. As a child, yes, absolutely.
9-year-old Stephanie, oh, I'm sad that I won. That's why I cutthroat and
Shut
beat
up.
You. No, but seriously, it does do a phenomenal job, I think, like many games, of teaching us a particular mindset. And that's really why we're interviewing Tom, is because Monopoly has such huge influence. What would happen if Monopoly had actually been what Maggie designed it to be, a game about shared resources and shared property, you know, taxation of property so that wealth is spread around?
And giving you a chance getting out of the poorhouse.
Yeah, I mean, what if it was like that?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what Tom is saying, it probably wouldn't have sold as well, but the impact on society might have been quite positive.
It wouldn't have been played. That's the point. You see, it would have not been as successful.
Do you think that games have to be inherently competitive in order to be fun?
I guess the Monopoly game hit a certain nerve at its time, and it came out, I think it was 34, 35. So let's not forget, we were depression times. So people in general were actually quite, let's say, desperate for financial success. And it's quite amazing that it had such a hit first Christmas then. I think it was the first million they made.
When it was actually Monopoly, not...
It was Monopoly. It was the copied Monopoly version with all the mistakes which were copied, which I find in hilarious detail, you know, that you can you can copy a game and then even copy the mistakes.
Steal
the spelling mistakes.
Yeah, I mean...
Fantastic.
The interesting thing is, like, how this game was stolen and, like, based in this whole kind of, you know... steeped in scandal almost, and you know, the game itself is also teaching cutthroat competition, so it's very consistent with itself in its own history.
I like the story of Tom very much because it's kind of almost it almost is like a mirror where we're looking into and like see ourselves in it, right? Like the way he discovered Monopoly in the attic of his granddad's house and then started playing it, discovering this whole story behind it. And then this whole story of how Monopoly actually monopolized Monopoly, and how people get into playing Monopoly and this whole competition thing and ruthless competition and, you know, and then look at us today.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a pretty clear reflection of the world we're living in. But what it doesn't capture is the, I mean, it bankrupts all the other players, but it also doesn't capture the impact on Earth of that kind of cutthroat competition, you know, and these external costs that we've been coming across in all these other interviews where people are talking about how companies, the price of a product isn't really reflecting its total cost. And here we have Monopoly that does exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Actually, a lot of people all over the world know Monopoly, and they know it really well.
Well,
but the rules are so, let's say, embedded in our thinking already that they become natural behavior in gaming. And then when you, once you play it in the game, no wonder that you play it outside that game world too.
Yeah, well, it's our first introduction. For a lot of people, it's their first introduction to money and the power of money. You know, money can buy property. Money gets you rent. Money allows you to build hotels and houses and get out of jail. And those are all very clear links to the real world. And so why wouldn't you take those lessons, those habits that you formed playing Monopoly, and apply them to real life?
Right. And so what I really appreciate about what Tom is doing now is to revive the original Landlord's Game, which had so much more, let's say, complex thinking behind it, and brings out, I think it was 10 rules which were really changed, and which changed the entire game dynamics and the entire outcome of the game. And imagine if you... if you don't know Monopoly, you're maybe in an Asian country or somewhere in Africa where definitely people know a lot less about Monopoly as the game. And you introduce the Landlord's Game and actually also the history of how this game basically with them was monopolized, we would have a completely different, I think, understanding of what a money game is.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that the game originally was designed by a woman who was actually criticizing this kind of winner-take-all system. And we see this theme time and time again where women are seen as the kind of caregivers and the people with perspective of the whole and the healers. And yet this kind of more masculine system of winner-take-all economics tends to prevail. And you know, I think we're going to get more into the gender dynamics in this podcast as we move forward. And we have an upcoming, as you know, like we're excited about our interview with Osprey Lake, who is about women's empowerment in all these dimensions, especially the care for the earth.
Elizabeth Maggie was not just any woman. She was an extremely powerful, intelligent woman, and I think a true visionary of her time. And that she actually tackles the monetary system in 1904, you know, is really remarkable, way ahead of her time. And no wonder that she was also suppressed and, you know, that this whole thing with Monopoly, yeah, kind of happened how it happened. Kind of the sad side of the story. But it's also an inspiring side in a way, you know, sort of like what to look out for if you do a money game today or if you do something inventive or visionary for the future, like what to look out for, because in a way we still have the kind of same, more or less same setup, same structures, power structures working today as she had been faced with.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.